Now, this is that chapter I was just talking about. It's all about the specialness of water. We see a small population of water molecules here. We've already talked about the fact that it's a polar compound. And here we see the swiveling I was talking about, just an example with only water molecules. It happened with any polar molecules. Water is polar because the electronegativity values of oxygen and hydrogen are quite different, and therefore unequal sharing of electrons, and water molecules will swivel so that the partially positive end of one will be facing the partially negative end of another water molecule. And that makes that population of water molecules a little bit more ordered, like I was saying, compared to population of nonpolar molecules. Well, that is the reason behind all of the various different special properties of water. So we're going to go through special properties, and they're important on their own, but all of them actually just spring from the fact that water is polar. Starting with slide 2. Here we're looking at a tree to represent a plant. It would happen in a small plant as well, but trees can be pretty big, including the largest organisms that have ever lived. Sequoia trees, quite high. But in any given vascular plant, plants with vessels, which is almost all plants alive nowadays, there is a continuous one-directional, one-way movement of water through the organism. Water enters the vessels through the root system from the soil, travels upward in the body of the plant, and eventually exits or leaves through the leaves. That entire movement process is called transpiration. Plants transpire. And that keeps them alive, which is important not just for the plant, but for all of us consumers that can't exist without those producers, which plants are examples of. But notice it's always an upward movement, which is always against gravity. It's lifting water. Well, you don't get to lift water for free, right? Because, as long as gravity is there. So on Earth, you can't move water for free against the force of gravity, upward, in other words. So there has to be something behind this movement. And on the right side, this cartoon represents an extremely close-up view of a tiny diameter vessel, one of millions in the plant's body, through which water moves. And, of course, you see some water molecules in there. The hydrogen bonds that I've already talked about are at play here because the water molecules are polar, as we've already talked about. So are the molecules that make up the walls of the vessels, even though that detail isn't shown. And there are two forces, two names, given to the force of attraction because of hydrogen bonding. It's really the forces aren't different, but we use two different names depending on what is attracting what. And those two names, as you see, are adhesion and cohesion. The only difference, really, is that adhesion is a force of attraction between different types of particles. What's represented there, what's labeled as adhesion is hydrogen bonding between water and the molecules of the vessel itself, the walls. Cohesion, using that co meaning shared prefix again, is force of attraction between the same kinds of particles. So hydrogen bonding between one water molecule and another, since they're both water, is cohesion. But it's the same thing, really. It's because of the same reason. They're polar molecules, and therefore hydrogen bonding is occurring. Each individual hydrogen bond is tiny in magnitude, far, far less than an ionic bond, like I said before, which is why they're not chemical bonds. But despite being tiny individually, they can add up to quite a big force if there's a lot of them. And so what we have here really is analogous to a train of molecules, train just like a freight train. A freight train really has only one, sometimes it's more than one, but at the beginning there's an engine, right? That's what's providing the force. But the rest of the train follows because all of them are linked, car to car. The linkages between the train cars are the molecules, are the hydrogen bonds between water molecules. So you have this one in the lead pulling all the ones behind it. Or it's pulling the one behind it, and then that one's pulling the one behind it, and so on. What's causing the lead to go higher, if you imagine the part that's above this, if there's no water molecule there, it will be attracted up to the wall because of hydrogen bonding. Capillary attraction. Just like if you have a very narrow glass tube, a capillary tube, that you put onto a drop of blood, it will go against gravity right up that glass because of hydrogen bonding. Same thing happening here. And so when that lead one moves up, it will drag the others behind it. Now, you have to appreciate how much force this is overall. And so think about a sequoia tree, which is enormously tall. Think about how hard it would be to move water up there if you had to do it via a pump. It would be a lot of pumping. Now, speaking of pumping, now think of the water in your the pipes of your home. You know, you're used to that just working. Whenever you turn it on, water comes out. Why is it that works? Well, physically, it works because there's a pressure gradient. The pressure is higher in the pipe than it is out in your sink, and therefore it comes outward. But why is it pressurized to begin with? What causes the pressure of the water system in the city? I mean, do you have a water pump that's forming that pressure? Probably not. The water is pressurized because it's falling. Water's going downhill to get to your house. That's the pressure. In the plain states that don't really have any hills, so to speak of, you'll see a bunch of water towers in towns. A tank of water that's taller than the houses. And so the water's just coming, falling downhill. Gravity is providing the force to cause that pressure in your pipes. You build a building taller than the water tower, it's not going to go any taller than the water, any higher than the tower, I mean. So, in fact, if you do build a tall building, you have to have a dedicated pump to get that water uphill. A skyscraper would need a very powerful pump to do that. Well, the Sequoia is like a skyscraper, only there's no electrical pump operating in it. It's all because of this capillary attraction, which is impressively big. And in fact, it's likely that Sequoia trees have evolved to be just about as tall as it's possible, because the taller they are, the more force there is on that train, right? If you, instead of a train, think of a metal chain. All of it's on the floor at first, but you pick it up by one link. And as the more you pick it up, the heavier it gets, right? Because you're dragging more and more links behind. Similarly, the taller the tree is, the more these hydrogen bonds are stressed, because you have a longer train being pulled down by gravity. If it got any taller, it probably would break those chains. It would cause cavitation in here. The engine would keep going, but the rest of the train would be left behind, and so it wouldn't be feasible to life. All right, anyway, let's go to slide 3. Here we have an animal walking on water, and you are a fellow animal, but you probably can't do this. If you try to do this, you'll sink. There's one advantage that this animal has over you, and that it can spread its legs out very far, but that's not really the point here. Where the legs are contacting the water, you can see little indentations, and it looks as though the water has a skin or a film that's thick, preventing it from penetrating. And it actually doesn't just look like that. That is true. It's water, no different from the water at depth below it. But the surface is a little thicker and denser than the water at depth. If we draw a little beaker and put in trillions of water molecules, I'm only going to do a subset of trillions. All the water molecules are polar, as we've been talking about. So each of those water molecules is being attracted, or the ones that are at depth, not at the surface, everything else. Those are all being attracted more or less in all directions to water molecules around them in all directions. So they're being pulled in all directions equally. But the ones that are at the surface are being pulled down because there are water molecules there, but there's nothing above them to pull them up. And so that very, you know, just the first few molecules of water at the surface become compressed compared to the ones at depth. And that little layer of water is actually a higher density, less space, and therefore tougher to get through. And that's why this animal is able to walk on water.
Surface tension.
It is surface tension, yes. All right, slide 4. The actual location of this map doesn't really matter. That's just a specific example, LA and San Diego. The point is that you have a large body of water right up against a large body of land. And there's actually a couple things I want to say about this. I'm going to give you two properties that matter here. One is that when the sun comes out each day, it is not hitting just the ocean or just the landmass. The sun is shining on both, right? And so it's delivering the same amount of energy to the water, body of water, as it is to the landmass. Not surprisingly, both of them heat up during the day compared to night. And then when the sun goes down, they're going to cool off, both of them. So temperature is going to go up and down. It's going to oscillate daily. Shouldn't surprise you. But a difference with respect to water versus land is that water is not going to undergo as much change from day to night in its temperature. So it's going to have less of an amplitude, which is how the difference between the high point and the low point. It's going to oscillate like this. The land mass is going to have a higher amplitude. It's going to get hotter during the day and cooler during the night. And that's because water, compared to land, is harder to change its temperature, given the same amount of energy. It's harder to heat, it's harder to cool. Now, the reason this has such biological implications is because something that we tend to forget, since we are land dwellers, life started in the oceans. And for most of the history of life, roughly 4 billion years, most of that time, that's the only place there was life. It's only fairly recently, 700 million years or so, that there's life on land. Long time from your point of view, but not all that long in terms of the history of life. It makes sense that life started in the oceans, because this means water is a much more stable environment thermally than land is. doesn't undergo such extremes as land. But why is this biophysically? Well, I told you already that all of these properties of water spring from the fact that it's polar. But the property I'm talking about now that makes this more stable as an environment is called specific heat capacity. So just like electronegativity, any given substance has a value for specific heat capacity. This is just a different property. Specific heat capacity gives you an idea of how difficult or easy it is to heat that stuff up. But let me give you a formal definition. Specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of exactly 1 gram of that stuff, whatever it is, by 1 Kelvin, or 1 degree Celsius, which is the same size. And therefore, any given substance will have a value for this, but the higher the value is for specific heat capacity, the harder it is to raise the temperature. Just in familiar terms, if you cook, you have equally hot pans and you put equal volumes of oil in one and water in the other, which is going to get hotter immediately. The oil will get hot very much more easily than water because it has a much lower specific heat capacity. In other words, if you have a given amount of energy that you put the same amount of energy into two substances, the one with the higher specific heat capacity will warm up, of course, but not as much. The temperature won't change as much as it will in the one with the lower specific heat capacity. And the ocean has a higher specific heat capacity than the land does. So the land heats up more and cools down more at night. That's because of specific heat, that's because of polarity of water, because, well, we have to remember what I told you temperature is. What is temperature an indication of? Average speed has to do with movement. It's the average speed, though, how fast the motion is of the particles. If you add thermal energy, heat, to a substance, that energy goes into moving the particles faster, which is why it heats that stuff up. The average speed goes up. But in a nonpolar population of molecules, much more of that thermal energy can go into making them faster. In a polar population like water, some of that energy, before it actually speeds the molecules up, is going to have to go into breaking the hydrogen bonds so that they can escape each other and go faster. So that's where some of the energy needs to be spent, just breaking the hydrogen bonds. And therefore, polar molecules have a higher specific heat capacity. All right. Another thing, though, about this, using this same map, is that you see that the parts of the land that are right on the water tend to have lower temperatures, and then the temperatures will be higher inland. And this is because of evaporative cooling, something that saves your life every day as someone who lives in the valley. We are mammals, and we sweat. Mammals have sweat glands that deliver, it's a solution, but it's mostly water onto the skin, which evaporates, and that removes heat from the body, keeping you livably cool. Otherwise, you would die. But all of that has to do with another property that I'm going to give you, which is the latent heat of vaporization. Now,
Now, this word vaporization is really just a synonym of evaporation.
But what is evaporation anyway? It's a change in state. Evaporation refers to some of the population of particles in the liquid phase going off on their own into the gas phase. So recall, before we go on, the difference between a liquid and a gas. We discussed this a little bit in lab, right? What is the big difference? Just the spacing, exactly. It's the same exact particles in both, liquid and gas. But in the gas phase, they're much farther apart from each other than they are in the liquid phase. All right? The latent heat of vaporization is the amount of energy required to turn exactly 1 gram of that stuff from liquid form or state to gas state. In other words, the amount of energy required to evaporate exactly 1 gram of that stuff. And the higher the value is, any given substance has this property you can measure, but the greater the value, the harder it is for that stuff to evaporate, meaning the more energy is required. Well, in the sweating example, that energy comes from your body. It's heat that you're trying to shed so that you won't die. And you evaporate the sweat. You know, if you bike in the valley, when especially July and August, doesn't seem really like you're sweating while you're biking. Seems fine, but then as soon as you make a stop, convenience store or whatever, it seems like just all of a sudden you are drenched in sweat and it just started. Well, it didn't just start. You have been sweating at that rate while you were biking, but the biking, with all the airflow across your skin, that enhances the ability to evaporate the water. And so it wasn't building up on you, it was evaporating, and that's what kept you alive. Because the heat that removes from your body keeps you within lethal limits of body temperature. Now, when water evaporates from a surface, and that surface is liquid water, of course, because it's going into the gas state when it evaporates. When water evaporates, that evaporation event will cool the liquid that remains behind. So more evaporation occurs, the colder the water gets. And you can easily demonstrate this to yourself. If you use tap water that's as hot as you can safely bear it, just almost can't touch it, it's so hot, fill the rag with that. But then just spread it out and flap it in the air 10 times, it will not only be easy to touch now, it'll be noticeably cool. And that's because you've evaporated some of those water molecules away, and what's left behind is at a much lower temperature. So evaporation cools the water, the liquid water, but it also, maybe non-intuitively to you, cools the air into which the evaporation occurs. It cools both the water and the air. And let's talk about why this is true using, well, I have to draw a new beaker. It's the same thing. Many water molecules. Now, if you're going to evaporate, first of all, it's not going to be equally possible for the entire population. Evaporation occurs from the surface of the liquid. So let's just think about this in terms of eligible molecules. The ones that are at depth at the moment are not eligible because they're at depth. They're always moving around, so though they might make it to the surface eventually. But only the ones at the surface have any chance of evaporating at this moment. And by evaporating, I'm just talking about going off from this crowded population into the air where they can space out a lot. If you restrict your attention to just the subpopulation that's at the surface, which ones of those have the best chance of escaping? Well, what has to be true of any molecule that's escaping? And don't overthink this, just think of it in common sense terms. Escape is an important word. Can you escape from prison by sitting in the cell? No, you have to be moving, right?
You have enough energy.
Right, to escape you have to go from where you are to somewhere else. So, speaking of energy, which ones of these molecules at the surface are the most likely to escape? Yeah, but we've already said the surface. So there's trillions just at the surface. Which ones of those are the most likely to actually escape? Which are the ones that are the fastest? Right, the fastest moving ones of that population at the surface are the most likely to escape the liquid population and go off into the air. All right? Now think once again about what I keep telling you temperature is an indication of. Average speed of particles. When you get rid of the fastest ones that are in the liquid population because they escape, what happens to the new average of the ones left behind? It goes down. You've gotten rid of the fastest ones in the class. When the average goes down, that means the temperature goes down. Temperature is that average. So that cools the water. But it also cools the air, I said. Well, the air has fast-moving water molecules in it already, most of which are faster than the ones that are just barely escaping the liquid. So they're fast from the viewpoint of the liquid, the ones that escape, but they're more likely to be slower than the ones that are already out there in the gas phase. So when you add those to the average speed in the air, it lowers that as well. And both of them get cooler. This is why an evaporative cooler works if you've ever had one in your house. It's really just dripping water onto a surface through which you blow air. That air, forced air through that, evaporates the water that's being dripped. It goes into gas phase, and that cools the water, which you don't really care about so much, but it also cools the air, which then gets pumped into your house. It's humid air, but it's cool. And the same thing happens with sweat. The liquid that's left behind is cooled. The energy required to get that evaporation to happen came from your body, and you are left alive. All right, five. Another remarkable property of water, quite unusual, is that unlike almost all other substances, water has a higher density as a liquid than it does as a solid. So we've been talking mostly about liquids and gases, right? Gases have a very low density compared to liquids because density is a measure of how much mass there is in a given volume. Well, the mass is in the particles, so the more particles you have packed together in a single volume, the higher the density. Liquid is much more packed together than gas, so liquids have a much higher density than gases. Solids, for most things, are even more packed. So for almost all substances, the solid form, whatever it's called, is more dense than even the liquid form. But not for water. We give them different names. We could call it solid water, but we usually call that ice. When we use the word water, we're usually referring to the liquid version of water. And we can call the gas form either water vapor or steam. It's all the same stuff, though. Well, if you take a chunk, meaning a solid piece of water, ice, put it into a glass of pure water to make ice water, you already know from experience that the water is, you're going to float on that water, on the liquid. But just about anything else, if you did that, that would not be true. If you take a solid and put it into a liquid of the same stuff, the solid, being more dense, will go right to the bottom. And it's a good thing that doesn't happen with water, because we wouldn't exist. The density of liquid is, water is greater, and therefore ice floats. If you think about a body of water like this shrimp is living in, because of seasonality, the coldest time of the year, there's going to be some freezing, transformation from liquid to solid, ice will form. And if ice were a conventional substance, were, in other words, if ice, the solid version, were more dense than the liquid version, then as that ice forms, wherever it does in the water column, it would sink to the bottom. And so each year there would be a buildup of some ice on the bottom. In the spring, you have the thaw because of increased sunlight, and some of that ice would melt, but not all of it. And then in the next winter, you would get another layer as big as the previous, but you'd start with some there already. And so it would get thicker and thicker each year, and eventually the whole body of water would be frozen, which would make it much less likely for organisms to live in and be able to evolve into stuff that eventually became us. It doesn't act that way, though, because the density of liquid is greater than solid for water, and therefore it's heavier, and that's why ice floats. The heavier water falls downward with greater force and forces the ice to the top. Not only does this keep the shrimp alive because it gives it a liquid medium in which it can move around and still live, but it also nicely means that the ice forms a nice protective covering over the winter, keeping the changes in temperature of the water less than they would be without that. So it's kind of doubly nice. The cartoons on either side of the photograph show you why this is true about density. It all has to do with polarity of water. And because of the angles, which are because of that tetrahedron shape I was talking about, when the water molecules swivel next to each other, it causes these kind of soccer ball-shaped patterns. That's in ice, because in solids, even though the particles are still moving, they're vibrating, they're not changing places. They're not trading places anymore. They're in one position. And so they're locked in this shape. And because of these angles, that means that there's a lot of space between them. In liquid, the big difference between that and a solid is that they are sliding past each other. They're trading places. So the swiveling still occurs, but they're not locked into place, because they haven't slowed down enough, so they're always breaking those hydrogen bonds, and therefore they end up getting closer to each other than they would be allowed to in the solid phase. It's less space, and therefore the overall sample is, the overall volume is more dense in liquid form. What am I doing here? Oh, this is the one that has a correct clock. Okay, well, let's go to 6. In 6, we can see in cartoon form that water makes for an excellent solvent. We've already defined those terms in lab, right? Solvents are things that dissolve solutes to form the overall solution, whatever the mixture is. And so a solution in which water is the solvent is an aqueous solution, as I discussed. There's plenty of other solvents, and water doesn't dissolve everything, so it's not a solvent that's good in all cases, but water does make for an excellent solvent for a lot of different things, including things that are either polar, which means they're partially charged, or fully charged, ionic, in other words. Salts dissolve very well in water, not just table salt, which we're using here as an example again, just salts in general, because they are ionic. And what you have here is some granules of salt in a beaker that you still see as salt for a while before the dissolution or dissolving occurs. But you don't see that if you come back a half hour later, right? Or if you stir it for a few seconds. It looks transparent. You don't see any salt grains anymore because it has dissolved. I think I mentioned this in lab. Once that happens, you no longer have sodium chloride, really. You call it a salt solution, but what you have is a solution that contains independently sodium ions and chloride ions, each dissolved in water. Because of the polarity of water molecules, at the surface of any size grain, you have, you know, the grain itself, the grain of salt is many, many sodium and chloride ions stuck together. But it has a surface to it where it's directly in contact with the water molecules somewhere. And at that surface, water molecules, because of their partial charges, can pick off an individual ion at a time and surround it. The ion gets surrounded in all three dimensions with a kind of a shroud or a sheet of water molecules that have swiveled appropriately so that their partial charge is right against the opposite charge of that ion. Notice that it's the hydrogens that are pointing toward the chloride ion, because the hydrogens are the delta plus part of the water molecule, the partially positive part. And it's covering it on all sides. They just didn't put it in the front, or you wouldn't see the chloride ion. That keeps that chloride ion in solution, keeps it from interacting with other ions. The sodium ion that gets picked up is also enshrouded by water molecules, but the swiveling is different, right? Here you have the partially negative oxygen end that's right up against and attracted to the positive charge of the sodium ion. So that's why it's no longer sodium chloride. The ionic bonds have been broken by the water. That solution, that is the dissolving of salt, and water is an excellent solvent for that because of its polarity. And that is really, there's so many of these things in this chapter that you wouldn't exist without. This is so important to life because it defines aqueous solutions and what life actually is aqueous solution chemistry. The metabolism that I've already said life is, which happens inside cells, well, that chemistry is aqueous solution chemistry, because it's happening in a liquid solution in which water is that solvent. The liquid that's inside the cell, the intracellular fluid, is an aqueous solution. That's where life happens. 7 is similar, except it shows you that water here is not dissolving a salt. It's dissolving, or dissolving is not really the proper term here. But it's similar to dissolution. This lysozyme purple thing here is an example of a protein. It's an enzyme. That's why its name ends in zyme, but that's not important here. It's a protein. Proteins are, compared to water molecules, enormous. They're complex polymers that we'll talk a lot more about eventually. But they're made up of a lot of different atoms, which is why they're huge molecules. And some parts of that same protein are partially positively charged, and some parts are partly negatively charged, including on the surface of the protein. Well, if the protein is in water, then it can be enshrouded by water molecules just like an ion can. They just swivel appropriately. If it's a partially negative part of the protein, then the water molecules swivel around so it's matched up with the partially positive. But the same protein will have partially positive parts, and the swiveling is just different. The water molecule surrounds the whole thing. So water makes an excellent solvent in general, even though there are some things like lipids, which are nonpolar, that don't dissolve in water at all. Which is why oil floats on water. Oil is a lipid. It's nonpolar. All right, eight. I don't know whether I'll finish this slide. It involves a little bit, but I'll certainly start it. What we see here in this figure is it's the transformation of normal water, as we've been talking about it, into ions. And nothing but water is involved here. It's doing this to itself, and therefore it's called the auto-ionization of water. Auto means self, right? Auto-ionization means forming ions out of yourself. And this happens to a certain extent in any sample of pure water. No other kinds of molecules involved, just pure water sample. And it happens because of the polarity also. But notice we have on the left here two normal complete water molecules. No overall charge. A molecule doesn't have an overall charge, right? It's not an ion. It has the same number of electrons and protons because the atoms that make it up had that to start with. So these two water molecules are just normal water molecules at the beginning. This is a reaction. It's a reversible reaction. Notice the double arrowhead. So it can go in either direction. But let's look at it going to the right. What happens is that it's possible, comparatively rare, so it's only a tiny fraction of the overall population of water molecules at any given moment that are going to do this. They all have the ability to do it, but most of them are not doing it at one time. But what's possible is that it looks like a hydrogen is being moved from a water molecule to the other water molecule, but it's not the entire hydrogen atom. What is it that really, though, defines the hydrogen atom? The proton, its nucleus, that's what defines it, right? And so if a hydrogen atom, neutral atom, is one proton and one electron. If you lose that electron from that hydrogen atom, the only thing you have left behind is a proton, right? Which is an ion. So there's three things that you should equate in your mind. Hydrogen ion, proton, same thing, and the symbol for either of those, which are the same thing, which is H+. When hydrogen loses its one electron, it is H+. Okay? So when you see H+ in printed text, pronounce that to yourself as hydrogen ion or proton. They are the same thing. But anyway, it's not an entire hydrogen atom, meaning not the proton and the electron, but just the proton from the hydrogen atom of one molecule is going to the other molecule. And that results in an ion, because you are passing a positive charge to something that is neutral at first, right? And that results in a hydronium ion, H3O+. But that's the one that receives the proton. That proton didn't just pop into existence. It came from the other water molecule, which now lacks that positive charge. And therefore, it's left with one more negative than it had positive, than it has positives. And that's a hydroxide ion, OH negative. So simultaneously, notice, two ions are formed just with one transfer, exactly as it happened for the ionic bond we looked at. It was just one electron being transferred between sodium and chlorine, but that one event simultaneously produced two different ions. Same thing happening here. just with water molecules. And the transfer is not an electron, it's a proton instead. Why would that electron be left behind on this water molecule?
Proton with the other one.
Right, but why not both, the proton and the electron? Why does the electron stay behind?
Because oxygen is greedy and it held on to it.
Exactly right, because oxygen has a high electronegativity. So it says, you can have the proton, I'm keeping the electron.
I ain't giving it up.
Right. Okay, so that simultaneously produces hydronium and hydroxide. So, since it's a simultaneous thing, what that means is you cannot, with auto-ionization of water, when there's nothing, no other kind of molecule involved, you can't make hydronium ions without also, at the same time, making an equal number of hydroxide ions. So in a pure water sample, almost all of the population of molecules are normal water molecules at the moment. But a very small percentage of them are either hydroxide ions or hydronium ions. And the number of hydronium ions exactly equals the number of hydroxide ions, because you can't make one without the other. So all that makes sense? Now, this happens, but actually when it happens, the hydronium ions don't necessarily stay hydronium ions. They can easily lose the proton they just received, and you have just a hydrogen ion in solution, a proton, on its own. So you can think of this as happening just with one water molecule. If one water molecule, normal to start with, loses a proton, what's left behind is going to be a hydroxide ion, and the other thing, the proton that's lost, is an ion in its own right, a hydrogen ion, and therefore hydrogen ions equal, in number, equal hydronium ion, equal hydroxide ions. We're going to talk next time about pH, which is a scale that defines acidity or alkalinity. Well, that has to do with the relative abundance of either hydroxide ions or hydrogen ions in solution. And pH really matters to how chemistry happens in cells and therefore affects life. But I'll explain the rest of it next time. Do I have to remind you not to show up on Monday? Well, you can show up. I'm not going to be here.